You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Kathleen Fulbig, the Australian child murderer. Kathleen Megan Fulbig, known as one of the worst female serial killers in Australia, was convicted of murdering her four infant children, 8-month-old Patrick Allen, 10-month-old Sarah Kathleen, and 19-month-old Laura Elizabeth. She would receive a manslaughter charge for Caleb Gibson, the firstborn, age 19 days old. These supposed murders took place between the years of 1991 and 1999. Kathleen, who often goes by Kathy, or Kath, has always said that she was innocent and said that all four of her children died of natural causes. Now, March 2021, there are scientists appealing for her release. So how did we get here? How do we have a mother accused of murdering all four of her children? Why are scientists petitioning for her release? And why now is this case back in the spotlight? Let's dive in. Kathleen Megan Donovan was born June 14, 1967 to parents Thomas John Britton and Kathleen May Donovan. Not much is known about her parents, but we do know Kathy's father, Thomas, was a dock worker and a heavy drinker. And her mother, Kathleen herself, enjoyed drinking. This would cause arguments in their relationship, and one night it would escalate further than anyone could expect. On January 8, 1969, just 18 months after Kathy was born, Kathleen and Thomas were home drinking, and they got in an argument. Kathleen became agitated and stormed out of the house and began walking down the street. Thomas came out after her, shouting for her to come back as he followed her out the door. Kathleen wouldn't come back and kept walking. Suddenly, Thomas became angrier, walked right up to her, and began stabbing her for a total of 24 times. A witness on the street said that after Thomas brutally stabbed Kathleen, he knelt down to her while she laid on the ground bleeding and kissed her. Then looking down at her said, "I'm sorry, darling," before he turned to the stranger saying, "I had to kill her because she'd kill my child." Thomas would be arrested the next day after the murder, and little Kathy, just shy of two, was then made a ward of the state and placed in the care of a foster couple. Within 6 months, on July 18, 1970, Kathy would be removed from foster care of the first couple and placed into the Bedora Children's Home in Sydney. It's not stated why she was removed from this first foster care situation and placed into this child's home. Around the age of three, September 1970, Kathleen would be placed in the home of Mrs. and Mr. Marlborough. This couple not only provided foster care for her, but they also eventually expressed the desire to actually adopt Kathy. Her foster parents and siblings reported that Kathy had a hard time settling into foster placement and was often disconnected from others, very emotionally flat, and at times would have uncontrollable tantrums and be inconsolable. Kathy states that when she was living with the Marlboroughs, though, she felt as though she was treated more of a slave than a child and felt isolated, not getting to spend much time with her friends. The Marlboroughs felt like there were times of happiness in her childhood with them, but they noted that she really struggled to form any kind of stable attachment with them and with most people. When the Marlboroughs took her in, they were aware of her past and what had transpired. There was often speculation that young Kathy had witnessed her mother being murdered, yet there is no definitive documentation to such. So while they noted these behaviors with Kathy, they said for them they understood because of the disadvantaged start that she had had in life. However, Kathy had no clue growing up that her father had murdered her mother. In fact, all she knew as she grew was that she was adopted. Then the day after her 16th birthday in 1984, she was told not only had she not been adopted like she had actually thought, she was still a ward of the state in foster care. And on top of that, the reason she was placed in state care was because her mother had been murdered by her father when she was just a toddler. Kathy, like anyone, would take this news very hard.
Kathy came to school. It was the day after her 16th birthday. Just sat down and said, "I'm not adopted. My parents are only foster parents. And they've just told me all this yesterday." Kathy told me that her father had murdered her mother, which is how she ended up in the foster care system.
In 1985, Kathy was attending Katora High School, but things at home were becoming unbearable and she felt like she just had to leave home and quit school. Kathy would decide to leave the Marlboros home and began taking jobs to try to support herself. Kathy worked a few dead-end jobs until she met 25-year-old Craig Gibson Falbig in 1985. By 1987, Craig and Kathy had been in a relationship for a little over a year, and they decided to buy a home in northwestern Newcastle, a New South Wales suburb of Mayfield, in May 1987. They would get married in September that same year. Then on February 1st, 1989, they would have their first child, Caleb Gibson Falbig. Kathy would make the decision to give up trying to work and to be a new mom and stay home to be a full-time mother. This created some financial problems, which tend to lead to arguments like with most marriages between couples. Craig, being the breadwinner, worked all day, which left Kathy to be the sole caregiver for her children both day and night. Craig was a very deep sleeper. He had a history of obstructive sleep apnea. Since this was a hereditary family condition, it seems as though it would be passed on to each of their children. Family and friends noticed Kathy really struggled bonding with Caleb. It seems as though she was very anxious about being a parent in general and about whether she even had the capability of being a good mother. She found that she truly enjoyed being at the gym, socializing with her friends more than being in Caleb's company. She had given up her job and was struggling being what felt like the only parental provider to their child. This would be a constant for Kathy as her marriage continued and they had more children. Now, Caleb, like his father, was known to breathe very heavily and noisily. His pediatrician would diagnose him with a mild case of laryngomonasia. Please be kind, that was a really hard word for me to pronounce. Also known as floppy airway. This is when a baby's larynx or voice box is soft and floppy. When the baby takes a breath, the part of the larynx above the vocal cords fall in and temporarily block the baby's airway. Babies that experience this will have a sharp, squeaky sound when breathing in and out, and it occurs as soon as the baby is born, but can also generally develop over the first few weeks and then get worse over time. Most children outgrow this over time. Some severe cases do require surgery to help the babies feed better or to breathe. The night of February 19th, Caleb would stir most of the night, awaking in his sleep, and Kathy would attend to him many times, putting him back to sleep. On the morning of the 20th, around 2:15 a.m., Craig would awake to Kathy's scream. Craig rushed into the sunroom where Caleb slept. There he would find Kathy standing over Caleb's crib, screaming, "My baby, there's something wrong with my baby." Craig would call an ambulance, but Caleb could not be saved. A coroner would rule Caleb's death as SIDS, a tragic loss of a child only 19 days old. The following year, Kathy and Craig would welcome another child, Patrick Allen Falbig, born June 3rd, 1990. Friends of Kathy would say while she was pregnant with Patrick and after his birth, she mentioned being anxious about losing another child. But everyone kept telling her, "SIDS is rare. This is not something that should happen again." Since Craig worked a lot during the first month of Caleb's life and losing him like that, Craig decided that he would remain home the first 3 months to help his wife care for his newborn baby. He wanted to give her the support she needed through the first few months since she was so anxious. After the 3 months were up, Craig had now had to return back to work. And again, Kathy was doing the primary care of Patrick herself, day and night. When Patrick was about 4 months old on October 18th, 1990, Kathy had put Patrick down for the night. Around 10:30 p.m. that night, Craig looked in on him and Patrick was sleeping peacefully in his crib. Around 3 a.m., Craig would awake to hear Kathy screaming once again. Craig rushed into the room to see Kathy standing over Patrick's crib and found Patrick face up with very shallow, labored breathing. Craig instantly began CPR, and Kathy rushed to the phone and called an ambulance. Thankfully, with Craig's CPR and the ambulance, they were able to save Patrick. However, Patrick did develop severe brain damage. and it would leave him with epilepsy and blindness. Patrick would go on to have epileptic seizures as well. 4 months later, on February 13th, 1991, Kathleen was doing the typical routine of putting Patrick down for his nap and checking on him throughout. Kathy says she went to check on Patrick and again found him unresponsive in his crib. Craig was at work, so she ran to the phone and called an ambulance. Kathy then phoned Craig at work, telling him, "It happened again." Craig immediately left work, rushing home, only to arrive just as the ambulance was pulling away from their home. Patrick was taken to the hospital, but was reported dead on arrival. The autopsy would reveal matter of death as asphyxia due to obstructed airway and epileptic fits. After the loss of another child, the couple decided to move to Thornton, a town northwest of Newcastle, a suburb of Maitland. On October 14, 1992, Kathy would give birth to her third child, Sarah Kathleen Fulbig. Kathy would later say that Sarah was the cheekiest child ever. She'd stick her tongue out at you just to get a laugh. Friends said that Kathy was very attentive to Sarah and wouldn't leave her alone with other people, not even friends or family. Her friends just assumed that it was due to her losing two other children, and they themselves were not trained in CPR or had any kind of training to help revive a baby. Things seemed to be going well with Sarah. She was now 10 months old. Little Sarah ended up catching a cold midway through August and began struggling with sleeping. She'd awakened many times, and Kathy, again, was having to get up many times throughout the nights and try to get Sarah back to sleep. Shockingly, they would lose Sarah on August 29th, 1993, at just 10 months old. Kathy states she went into Sarah's room to check on her around 1:30 a.m. and saw Sarah lying in her crib, face up, unresponsive. Craig says he woke once again to the screams of Kathy. He rushed out of bed and down the hall to find Kathy standing in Sarah's doorway screaming. An ambulance was called, but they would not be able to revive Sarah. Autopsy would determine that her cause of death was SIDS. Then in 1996, the couple would move to Singleton, and on August 7th, 1997, Kathy would give birth to their last child, Laura Elizabeth Fulbig. When they first brought Laura home, she was a very healthy baby. But still, her parents religiously monitored Laura's sleep patterns and breathing patterns in the beginning due to the loss of her siblings. Laura was the light of her family. She was remembered as such a beautiful little person. Family remembers celebrating her first birthday with such a sigh of relief, since none of the other children were able to make it to such a milestone. And at only 19 months old, just as suddenly as they had lost their other three children, on the 1st of March, 1999, tragedy would strike again. Laura had caught a little cold that week and was having trouble sleeping. That morning, Kathy decided to head to the gym after Craig went out to work and brought Laura with her. After working out, Kathy placed Laura in her car seat and drove home. On the way, Laura had fallen asleep in her car seat, so Kathy took her out, carried her in, and laid her down. After about 15 to 20 minutes later, Kathy went to check on Laura and found her unresponsive. Kathy again raced to the phone, called 911, and began CPR.
Ambulance
emergency? I need an ambulance. My baby's not breathing.
Okay, and how old's your baby?
20 months old. Can you just hold a minute? I'm trying to do CPR.
20 months old.
I'm getting any heartbeat or anything.
Okay, do you know why this is?
I've had three SIDS tests already.
Pardon?
I've had three go already.
And your name?
It's Kathy.
The ambulance arrived to find Kathy standing over the breakfast bar where Laura was laying face up. At this point, Laura was not breathing and had no pulse. They were not able to revive little Laura. In the autopsy, they did find inflammation of Laura's heart muscle. They noted that she had contracted cold-like illness just a week before her death. Laura's death was ruled undetermined. Due to Laura's age, her death wouldn't fall under the parameters of SIDS. At this point, police were tipped off that something was possibly happening in this home to these children. The coroner couldn't tell investigators with 100% confidence that Laura wasn't suffocated, but at the same time, they all knew it would be hard to prove that theory. After three previous deaths, and now Laura, alarm bells were going off. Investigators really felt at this point, based on how these children's deaths happened and that Kathy was present for all of them alone, that there was a huge possibility that she was the one responsible for their deaths. But they had no solid evidence they could use to bring charges against her. That is until a few months after Laura's death, Craig calls the police department and says he wants to talk to investigators. Shortly after Laura's death, Kathy had decided to end things and leave Craig. She had thought she had packed all her belongings, but when Craig was cleaning out her nightstand, he found a shocking discovery. Craig told investigators he'd always had a feeling that something was wrong with his children's deaths, and noted that Kathy's tempers and frustrations with the children at times made him wonder if she could have been responsible for harming them, now looking back, especially after he discovered a diary that Kathy had left in her nightstand, and the entries were alarming and disturbing. Craig brought the diary to investigators, and after they read the diary, they too began to believe that Kathy was responsible for all four of her children's deaths. Here's some of those entries from Kathleen's diary. January 2nd, 1998. Very depressed with myself, angry and upset. I've done it. I've lost it with her, she wrote in reference to baby Laura. I yelled at her so angrily that I scared her. She hasn't stopped crying. Got so bad I nearly purposely dropped her on the floor and left her. I restrained enough to put her on the floor and walk away, went to my room and cry, a reference to Laura. Was gone probably only 5 minutes, but it seems like a lifetime. I feel like the worst mother on earth. Scared that she'll leave me now, like Sarah did. I knew I was short-tempered and cruel sometimes to her, and she left with a little bit of help. Think I handle her fits of crying better than I did with Sarah. I've learned to once getting to me to walk away, breathe in for a while myself. It helps me cope and figure out how to help her, she wrote. She's a fairly good-natured baby. Thank goodness it will save her from the fate of her siblings. I think she was warned, she wrote about Laura. With Sarah, all I wanted her to do was shut up. And one day, she did. Looking at the video, Sarah was boyish-looking. Laura was definite feminine features. They are chalk and cheese, and truly just as well. Wouldn't have handled another one like Sarah. She saved her life by being different. I think this baby deserves everything I can give her, considering I really gave nothing to the others. I think even my feelings towards this one are already deeper, she wrote, April 1997. And just a few weeks before Laura's death, Kathy would write, I'm tired all the time. Want to do nothing but sleep. It's not Craig, it's me. Plus, we don't get to go out to dinner or dancing together anymore. There isn't much, well, there's no romance between us anymore. It's all, let's make money and raise Laura. We've forgotten ourselves in this process. Sad how that happens. One of my problems is I've lost me again. I'm just Miss Craig Folbig now. I'm just Laura's mother as well. Where's Kath gone? A person in her own right who needs to have writing lessons. Probably better if I don't, then no one, not even me, will be able to read this when I'm gone. After speaking with Craig and now armed with this diary, investigators decided to pursue charges against Kathy for the deaths of her children. Kathy would be arrested in her home April 19th, 2001 and officially charged for the murder of her four children. Kathleen would finally be formally interviewed for the first time by investigators. Here's a clip of that interview.
Do you know what sort of person would kill four children?
I have no comprehension. I don't even want to think about it.
Kathy, did you kill Caleb?
No!
Did you kill Patrick?
No.
Did you try to kill Patrick on that near-miss episode?
No.
Did you kill Sarah?
No.
And did you kill Laura?
No.
Prosecutor Daniel Marr told the court during Kathy's bail hearing that the prosecution's evidence that they intended to present to the Crown would be Kathy's own diary, testimonies from her now estranged husband, and technical evidence from pathology experts. Marr stated that while each child's individual death had not raised much concern, their collective deaths could only be attributed to suffocation. Marr would go on to say that circumstances surrounding their death were not consistent with sudden infant death syndrome or cot death. The facts were that each child was found face up, still warm, and in two cases there were signs of life. He noted that Kathy also had not appeared to those around her to grieve the loss of her children after each death. Marr would go on to say that the diary entries may be circumstantial, however, they did contribute to her partial admission of guilt. Marr would also cite evidence from a United States forensic pathologist, Dr. Janice Opeven, that stated that chances of cot death being responsible were a trillion to one. What that means is that this is the only case that has occurred in the world, It's just not likely, he told the court. Nicholas Cowdery was the North South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions and was responsible for looking into all the serious cases and deciding whether there's reasonable prospect of conviction with the evidence collected. In 2003, he decided there was. Once Kathy was charged and the media picked up the story, it was everywhere. If Kathy was able to be found guilty, then she'd be known as the worst female serial killer in all of Australia, and that brought media attention from all over the world. The Crown's theory presented was that Kathy had killed each child in a moment of uncontrollable anger. Then seeing what she had done, once the anger subsided, would immediately seek help. Prosecution using Kathy's diary entries was able to also portray Kathy as a woman more preoccupied by her looks, her own life, and being more interested in going out to nightclubs and to the gym rather than being with her own children. The prosecution pointed to many diary entries that showed Kathy's obsession with her weight and her frustration of never being able to go to the gym because of her children. The prosecution would call witnesses that stated that Kathy showed no obvious reaction to the death of her four children. One of those witnesses would be a hospital nurse that described Kathy as detached. Another would be her neighbor, Deborah Grace, who would testify that after Laura's death, there were no tears in her eyes. There was nothing. Craig's testimony would be some of the hardest to digest. Craig would tell the court and the jury about how Kathy would become easily frustrated with the children and a terrifying growl she used with them. Craig recounted each children's death and then explained examples of Kathy's rage against the children. Craig told the court about the time Kathy was especially harsh on Laura, just hours before her death, that he cannot forget. Craig says that Kathy had pinned Laura to her high chair and attempted to force feed her before dumping her on the floor with the words, "Go to your fucking father." Kathy would not take the stand in her own trial. Instead, her diary would become her voice. The entries read really painted a picture of Kathy's mental state with each child and her thoughts and feelings after each child's death. To many hearing them, they felt as if they were private confessions of her guilt. Kathy would later argue this is not an admission of guilt over her harming her children, rather always blaming herself for everything she did as a mother. The diary, her husband's statements, and the police investigation alone was compelling, but the coroner's evidence really brought home the Crown's theory. Dr. Kala, who performed Laura's autopsy, would testify that he had found myocarditis, which is the swelling of the heart, but the state of the myocarditis found in the heart was not advanced enough and unlikely the cause of Laura's sudden death. And this was supported by other medical experts in the trial. Dr. Kala and the other medical experts involved in the trial also suggested that the three previous children's deaths should have been listed as undetermined and not SIDS. The prosecutor would point out to the jury that the first three children Kathy would find unresponsive in their beds, yet she wouldn't pick them up and she wouldn't attempt CPR. The defense counterargument was that Kathy was indeed a loving mother and there was no evidence that these children had been smothered. They pointed out that there was no definitive proof of abuse to either child. During cross-examination of the prosecution's medical experts, not a single medical witness could say with 100% certainty that these children had been suffocated because these experts themselves did not examine the death sites of each child in person. Less than 8 hours after closing statements from the defense and prosecution, the jury had a unanimous verdict. May 1st, 2003, Kathy would be found guilty by the Supreme Court of New South Wales. She was found guilty on one count of manslaughter, one count of maliciously inflicting grievous bodily harm, and three counts of murder. As the verdict was read in court, Kathy cried and buckled at the knees, turning herself towards the public gallery before slumping forward with her head in her hands. Observers said it was very hard to watch. On October 24, 2003, Kathy would be sentenced to 40 years with a non-parole period of 30 years. Kathy would appeal her sentence, and February 15, 2005, the court would reduce her sentence to 35 years with a non-parole period of 25 years. Kathy was housed and continues to reside in protective custody due to the nature of her crimes to prevent the possible violence from other inmates. This, however, would not be the end of this story. An academic by the name of Dr. Cunliffe would hear Kathy's case and begin to question the medical reports used in her trial and how they were presented towards the jury. She said at first, looking at the evidence presented, she felt they were on the right track in her conviction, until she dug deeper into the medical reports.
When I reviewed the case, I started from the position that the evidence had been strong. But I now believe much of the evidence that had been introduced at trial was unreliable. I think that the most striking evidence that the jury heard was from medical witnesses, each of whom was asked by the prosecution whether the medical literature documented three or more sudden unexplained deaths in a family being natural deaths. Every medical witness answered no to that question. I think the jury would have found that that really compelled a conclusion that the children were killed.
That led Dr. Cunliffe to reach out to Isabel Reed, a local barrister in 2013, to assist her in beginning the legal research into Kathy's case. For those of us outside of Australia who don't know what a barrister is an independent specialist advocate and advisor in law. Their highly competitive training, together with their specialist knowledge and experience, can make a substantial difference to the outcome of a case. They work at higher levels of the court than a solicitor, which is their lawyer, and their main role is to act as an advocate in legal hearings, which means that they stand in court and plea on the behalf of their clients in front of the judge. Barrister Reed's first steps were to write to medical experts, scholars, statistic experts, about Kathy's case. And the outcome was surprisingly overwhelming. Those experts started to write up their own reports and their own opinions about this case, completely free. Dr. Hill, a professor of mathematics at the University of Salford, is one of the experts that Dr. Cunliffe and Barrister Reed reached out to. Dr. Hill researched the statistics of infant mortality in families. What he found was that while multiple infant mortality in family is a rare event, so is multiple infant homicide. From his standing with these statistics, you couldn't just say that it's homicide and that it wasn't possibly SIDS. Another specialist that they reached out to, Sharmila Betts, a clinical psychologist in Sydney, wrote a report about the examination of Kathy's diary entries. She concluded that Kathy had a very rigid and exacting, highly idealized conception of what motherhood should look like. She noted that Kathy's diary reflected less admission of guilt and that it seems Kathy felt she was constantly failing to meet her own expectations of her own mothering abilities. The most impactful report came from Professor Stefan Kordner, a professor of forensic pathology at Monash University. He wrote a 150-page report examining the forensic evidence that had been presented at the trial. In the report, Dr. Hill concluded that Caleb's death was best regarded as SIDS. In the case of Patrick's death, he concluded that while his death was unexpected, there's a definite possibility that it could have been caused by the epilepsy that he experienced in the last 4 months of his life. When it came to Sarah's death, he did agree that there was, again, the probability of SIDS. And when it came to Laura, the professor agreed that it would have given the cause of death of myocarditis, or swelling of the heart muscle. Dr. Cunliffe and Barrister Reed would take the reports from all the experts and add them to their petition for an inquiry in 2015. The Australian story would cover Kathy's case, bringing new light to their theories. Even with the new evidence presented after 2015, Kathy's foster sister still believes that Kathy is responsible for those children's death. She feels it would be an injustice for her to be released. Kathy does have two close friends that have been by her side and have helped her fight for her freedom from the beginning that say people just don't understand the Kathy they know. She would never hurt her children.
My friend Kath is a good woman. I mean, it's horrible to look at the media and see the titles of Australia's worst serial killer, child killer.
Although a visit to the Clarence Correctional Centre in northern New South Wales has become a weekly ritual for Tracy Chapman, she's never gotten used to the idea her childhood friend Kathleen Folbig is a convicted killer.
We're coming up to 18 years since 2003 when she was incarcerated, and we've got more answers now about what's happening and had happened than we've ever had before. In terms of whether I've ever thought Kath killed her children, the person I know would never have done that.
Experts on the other side of this case still believe that Kathy is responsible for her children's death. They say it wasn't just the medical evidence that compelled them. It was Craig's own testimony, her own husband at the time stating what he had witnessed as far as Kathy's frustration with her children. How easily she got stressed and how angry she seemed to be around the children at times. Her demeanor after losing each children, as if it wasn't truly upsetting or she wasn't grieving. Then there's the diary. And it's hard for some people to read that diary and not see a confession of guilt. But then we have to step back and look at it from Kathy's side. If she's innocent and her children all died of natural causes, she lost 4 children, the most horrific pain a person can endure, and then was accused of being responsible of it. Not only did she lose her children, but she now lost her freedom and has been labeled a monster. It would be 3 years before New South Wales Attorney General Mark Speakman announced there would be an inquiry into Kathy's conviction. On August 22, 2018, Speakman would release the following statement about the inquiry.
Gabrielle Boyle reports.
Kathleen Fulbig, now aged 51, has always maintained her innocence. She's always said that she played no role in the death of all 4 of her children, Caleb, Sarah, Patrick and Laura. The children died over a 10-year period, and the suggestion was that they all passed away due to SIDS. Of course, a jury several years ago found her guilty of their deaths. But it was in the last few months we saw an inquiry launched to double check if this was the case. What it found late last night was that it reinforced her guilt and that there was no reasonable doubt surrounding her responsibility for their deaths. Let's hear a little of what the Attorney General had to say.
Mr. Blanche said that just about every physical and biological issue that could be raised had been raised. And I think it's important that the public has confidence that the jury system has worked in this case, that no stone has been left unturned.
In July 2019, the 500-page report released would show that the former chief judge of the District Cork found he did not have any reasonable doubt as to the guilt of Kathleen Megan Fulbig for the offences of which she was convicted. Justice Reginald Blanche found the inquiry only reinforced her guilt. Kathy's legal team countered that arguing bias during the inquiry and requested a further judicial review. The judge told Kathy's team they could not rerun the inquiry that found reinforcement in her guilt conviction, but that didn't stop Kathy's team. In August 2020, her team launched legal action towards Justice Blanche and New South Wales Attorney General Mark Speakman in hopes to get another shot at proving Kathy's innocence. It would be some time before any real movement would happen on Kathy's case, until just this month, March 4th, 2021.
It was an unimaginable crime that shocked Australia, this one. A mother convicted of killing her 4 infant children. But now there is new scientific evidence that could set Kathleen Fulbig free from jail.
Dozens of leading medical and scientific experts have joined a petition calling for her release. They claim the children likely died from natural causes.
The new genetic findings by 27 international scientists from Denmark, Italy, Canada, France, and the United States have been peer-reviewed and published in a top international cardiology journal, Eurospace. Their research findings states they examined a never-before-reported genetic mutation in Kathy's daughters, Sarah and Laura, that they inherited from Kathy. Biochemical experiments carried out by scientists in Denmark show the mutation known as CALM G114R variant is likely pathogenic and likely caused the daughters' deaths. The international team also noted they found a genetic mutation in both Caleb and Patrick that could explain their deaths. They found that both boys carried 2 mutated copies of a gene that caused early onset lethal epilepsy in mice. This was supported by Patrick's onset of epilepsy around 4 months before he died. The international team says the studies into the boys' variants are still in preliminary stages, where Sarah and Laura's has been studied in great detail. Will this new theory that all of Kathy's children died due to undiscovered rare genetic variants be the key to a new inquiry? Could this be just what Kathy's legal team needed the whole time to prove her innocence? Will advancements in science change the court's minds? Has it changed yours? For now, we'll have to wait and see what the future holds for Kathy's case. I hope I presented the facts in a way that allows you to make up your own mind, and I cannot wait to hear your thoughts. Was Kathy a mother who couldn't attach to her children or handle the stress of motherhood and snapped, smothering her children one by one in a moment of stress? Or was she a loving mother who lost her children to rare genetic mutations and was wrongly perceived because of her consuming grief that was mistaken for guilt? I cannot wait to hear what you all think. Don't forget to hit those share, like, and retweet buttons on those family and loved ones' missing and murdered posts on social media. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.